The information where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.
JFK, Solon, and the Atlantis Connection. Baron Lee outlines the mystical links between politics and our mythological past. Recorded at the Railway Club, Brighton, on Thursday, 28th of October, 2010. In the Railway Club in Brighton with Baron Lee and a computer and a projector. So we don't know what he's going to say, but it might be good. Someone's come in, it's Wayne.
Hi
Wayne, welcome to the information.
Yeah, I saw you coming here. Alright mate, how's it going?
Okay.
There's a lot of stuff going on now, especially in American stuff, where they're following Greek nomenclature and planets, missions they're putting into space. Everything's Greek. I'm like, why is it always Greek?
Yeah.
So I was always interested in JFK. So let's see what piece, because he's the first conspiracy theorist. You admit it. Like people said to me, you're a conspiracy theorist. I'm like, well, JFK was first before me. Let's start off that one first. Dr. Hermann Oberth, who pioneered rocket design for the German Reich during World War II, and later advanced rocket technology for the American manned space launches, cryptically stated, "We cannot take credit for our record advancements in certain scientific fields alone. We have been helped." When he asked by whom, he replied, "The people of other worlds." His quote, not mine. Oberth's fellow associate space pioneer, who's also said the Third Reich, Werner von Braun, echoed similar knowledge of the extraterrestrial realm when he stated in 59, this is 2 years before JFK's speech. From the above, Top Secret by Timothy Good, William Morrow and Company, 1988, says the following quote, "We find ourselves faced by powers," note the word powers, "which are far stronger than hitherto assumed, and whose base is at present unknown to us. More I cannot say at present, we are now engaged in entering into closer contact with those powers, and within 6 or 9 months' time it may be possible to speak with more precision on the matter." So this is just before JFK. JFK was shot for specific reasons, I think personally, but I won't go into it here. Okay. Thule member, anyone knows what the Thule Society is?
Yeah, Thule into the Nazis.
Yeah. Technical University of Munich declared, "In everything we recognise, two principles that determine the events, light and darkness, good and evil, creation and destruction, as in electricity, we know plus and minus," and that's fundamental to esoteric hermetics. Everything's to do with energy, and plus and minus is a negative and positive force. You can call them good or evil if you like, but they don't mean anything as good as evil. It makes no difference because this is energy. "It is always either or, plus or minus. Everything destructive is of satanic origin. Everything creative is divine. Thereby, every technology based on explosion or combustion has thus to be called satanic." I like that definition. It really works for me. "The coming new age will be an age of new, positive, divine technology." If you can get past the satanic stuff where they stop blowing things up. Because you can transform anything, but with them using alchemical magic, they're trying to create something that's special, which isn't really what we want.
You think that's linked to chaos magic?
Yeah.
Sex interesting,
magic. Sex magic, magic, yeah.
Sex magic.
Yeah. Okay. The dark stuff. Yeah. JFK 61. This is one of his major famous ones. I mean, this can be found anywhere, but this is the Astoria Chamber Police was filmed. It says, "My topic tonight is a more sober one of concern to publishers as well as editors, so it's to the main media. I want to talk about our common responsibilities in the face of a common danger." So he's coming to the commoners of the land, from this language. "The events of recent weeks may have helped to illuminate the challenge for some, but the dimensions of this threat have loomed large on the horizon for many years." It's funny when you read this, instead of listening to it, if you read the words, you go, what is he trying to tell the media? What didn't he get? It's quite clear. "Whatever our hopes may be for the future, for reducing this threat or living with it, there is no escaping either the gravity or the totality of its challenge to our survival." So this is no mean feat. "And to our security, a challenge that confronts us in unaccustomed ways in every sphere of human activity, So that's nice and luminous language, because he's telling you there's a problem. This deadly challenge imposes upon our society, meaning their membership to the Republic. Was it, I think he still recognised it was a kind of Republic hanging on. Our society requires two requirements of direct concern, both to the press and to the president, two requirements that may seem also almost contradictory in tone, but which must be reconciled and fulfilled. If we are to meet this national peril, so you've got all the keywords: danger, deadly, peril, gravity, totality, survival. They're all keywords.
Horizon as well.
Horizon, yeah. It's a new age, it's a new forming of something coming through. So he says, I refer first to the need for far greater public information, which is what the media is designed to do, the First Amendment. Second, to the need for greater official secrecy, which I can kind of understand, because he was trying to make deals with Khrushchev to go to the moon together as a one nation, but another plan that was scuppered. It was one of those memorandums of understanding, they had it verbally, but nothing was ever concrete. Pamela's son. Heard all this recently. We go to the best speech. The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society, and we are as a people inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, secret proceedings, concealment of pertinent facts, far outweigh the dangers which are cited to justify. And it goes on. Survival of our nation, carries on with the theme. If our traditions do not survive with it, being as a republic. And there is a very grave danger that an announced need for increased security will be seized upon by those anxious to expand its meaning to the very limits of official censorship and concealment. In other words, they're going to go over the line.
That's exactly what's happened.
Across the line.
Yeah.
That I do not intend to permit to the extent that is in my control. How long was it in his control for? Not long. Plus he was trying to get the power from the Federal Reserve and sort of into another authority's hands. Not necessarily trying to get them away from the Fed, but to give someone else the power to print if he wasn't there. It's like a dual
order. He wanted to bring back the green box.
He was trying to, but as soon as he'd done that first step, to give authority, he got
started, and that's the one thing they've got very much in common.
Yeah. Trying to get that back in and get the power back, but as soon as he started doing that, he took the wire. That was enough to get shots, I think. An excuse to censor the news, stifle dissent, cover up mistakes, and to withhold from the press and the public the facts they deserve to know, which we don't get. We know we don't get that. Especially in England, we don't. But I do ask every publisher, every editor, every newsman in the nation to examine his own standards and to recognise the nature of our country's peril. In time of war, the governments and the press have customarily joined in an effort based largely on self-discipline. And he confirms the courts have even held that even the privileged rights of First Amendment must yield to the public's need. So he's confirming there that even the courts have said, you've got to tell them the truth, that this is public domain. And he does like court systems, he does like democracy. We're going to try and see why. If the press is awaiting a declaration of war before it imposes the self-discipline of combat conditions, in other words, prepare yourself to tell me the truth, then I can only say that no war ever posed a greater threat to our security. If you are awaiting a finding of clear and present danger, then I can only say that the danger has never been it's never been more clear, and its presence has never been more imminent. So he's telling the entire media, problem. Big problem. First Amendment, Congress shall make no law respecting the sovereignty of religion, freedom of speech or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances. You don't get that in England either, you just get cattled. Get over to that speech zone over there. Did you get permission? Did you apply for that? It requires a change in outlook, a change in tactics, a change in missions by the government, by the people, by every businessman or labour leader, and by every newspaper. So that's kind of like everyone. For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy. So he says it. I'm not a conspiracy theorist, he is. That relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence, infiltration instead of invasion, subversion instead of elections, intimidation instead of choice, guerrillas by night instead of armies by day. It is a system, and he's very right, it's a completely ruthless system, which is very old. which has conscripted vast human and material resources into the building of a tightly knit, highly efficient Borg machine that combines military, diplomatic, intelligence, economic, scientific, and political operations. Because I think most of this is artificial. I'm convinced most of it is. I don't think any human could devise a system like this. Although a human might have invented it to be artificially led, but this is too cruel to be human. The system itself is ruthless. Its preparations are concealed, not public, its mistakes are buried, not headlined, its dissenters are silenced, not praised. No expenditure is questioned, no rumour is printed, no secret revealed. It conducts a Cold War in short with a wartime discipline no democracy would ever hope or wish to match. So he doesn't like it. He even calls it something that's separate from the Republic. He says, yeah, democracy, that's not good. Even a democracy wouldn't survive with it. Nevertheless, every democracy recognises the necessary restraints of national security, which most of us would. We don't want every barbarian knocking three gates coming through Dover, but the question remains whether these constraints need to be more strictly observed if we are to oppose this kind of attack, as well as outright invasion. So he's kind of worried. So he carries on addressing them. He says, perhaps there will be no recommendations, perhaps there's no answer to the dilemma faced by a free and open society in a cold and secret war. I don't know why he calls them free and open. I think that's quite true, but I think he's trying to infuse them all to say, you know, you've got one at the moment. If you think this is free, try and keep hold of it. In times of peace, any discussion of the subject and any action that results are both painful and without precedent, but this is a time of peace and peril which knows no precedent in history. 40 years ago? Well, it's nearly 50 years ago now, he's telling me. The debate, without debate, without criticism, no administration and no country can succeed and no republic can survive. America's getting ripped to bits, isn't it? Let's face it. Mm-hmm. America's getting ripped to bits. They've circumvented every single right that they've got there enough. Here's my point. I started looking at his speech and thinking, hang on, why is he mentioned so long? Why mention? Because these people, don't cite them for no reason. That is why the Athenian lawmaker Solon decreed it a crime for any citizen to shirk from controversy. And I can understand why he done that. And that's why our press was protected by the First Amendment. The only business in America specifically protected by the Constitution, so to speak up. Not primarily to amuse and entertain, not to emphasise the trivial and the sentimental, not to simply give the public what it wants, but to inform, to arouse, to reflect, to state our dangers and our opportunities, to indicate our crises and our choices, to lead, mould the Egyptian forming people, educate and sometimes even anger public opinion, which I don't even know why people aren't as angry as they should be. It takes us back to mind control and how good the media is. Mentions two other people which interested me. It was in the early 17th century that Francis Bacon remarked on three recent inventions already transforming the world: the compass, gunpowder, and the printing press. So he's quite clever that he identifies three things that changed the world completely, especially gunpowder. And so it is to the printing press, to the recorder of man's deeds, the keeper of his conscience, the courier of his news, that we look for strength and assistance, confident that with your help, man. Not a person. Man will be what he's born to be, free and independent. I thought that was a really powerful speech when I read that. I heard and thought, yeah, I get what you're saying, but when you read it, it's like, Jesus Christ, so many keywords. So we're going to look at these three. What's the link? So long. House of Representatives, it's very sense. Moses in the centre. Left of him, it's Confucius, and Solon's on the right. And the rear of the Supreme Court. This is Chris Pinto's work on the Americas, the New Atlantis. Yeah. And I think he's got some merit to it, you know.
Yeah. That was what Francis Bacon.
Francis Bacon. Who's doubled
the
up
New Atlantis.
Most of the scholars believe that he is the Shakespeare. Yeah.
And
you're
writing Shakespeare's plays, you mean?
They believe he was his persona, yeah. What's he called, a pseudonym or...
Okay, yeah.
His ghost.
Assume, yeah.
He was a Rosicrucian.
Yeah. So there's a lot of merit to him anyway, just Baconism. But who was Solon and why even reference him? I mean, what would the American president be talking about an Athenian Greek for? Athenian constitutional lawmaker in Greece, died 1559 BC, installed a dable democracy between rich and poor, and abolished archaic Draconian laws. You know, we were talking about last week about like really severe laws, the Code of Hammurabi, but just thrown into the fire. Well, he was worse. He was worse than those. No, Draconian was worse.
Draconian.
Well, he carried on the Sumerian dictatorial powers of saying, "Oh, you're going to get killed for everything you do." But he got rid of that. What he essentially done, Solon, is he realised that the country had been corrupted. He had the barons, or the richer people, the aristocracy, were trying to control the poor. So he came along and said, right, the currency that you got now, I'm going to remove it. I'm going to give you a different currency. So everyone's on an equal field. There's no debts. You don't owe him anything. You don't owe him anything. Get along together. We'll give you 10 years worth of laws. Don't change my laws for 10 years. And just let it all filter through.
Yes, I think we met.
So essentially, he wiped the slate clean economically, and then installed laws and said to them, "Don't touch me laws for 10 years. Just let everything settle and use this new currency and see where you end up." It all went a bit crazy for a bit, but he essentially got it. He got it nailed. But someone else done it thousands of years before him, in 2350 BC. Done exactly the same thing, just indebtedness, get rid of it. No one's in debt to anyone.
Sort of
like,
he
was doing the same thing. He was basically, that he realised that control of people, how you do it is you get them indebted. And if you can't get them out of it, then you wipe the slate clean. And it's happened twice before in history, because you always get to the point where it's a tyrannical system. And then you have a good guy that comes along and thinks, okay, this can't go on. We'll change it. You know, we've got to change it, we've got to eradicate the debt. So Bacon mentioned the compass, which is important for circumnavigation, naval process, admiralty law, banking, gunpowder. If you've got the biggest bank, you'll win wars. Did I?
Yeah.
So program ages ago, we dug up a ship of the Queen, one of the ship's armadas, one of the Queen's armadas from the fleet. And they realised that when they'd done the cast, they rebuilt the gun from the original script, the original casting. And they realised that when they built it, the thing wouldn't blow up, it wouldn't crack. And you could send a ball a mile of distance, because the metalwork was so good in Egyptian, in Elizabethan times. The cannons were a lot stronger. It wouldn't blow up and could take about 4 people with it, operate. So that's how they got supremacy of the seas. Basically doing that, gunpowder and metallurgy, alchemy, you can say alchemy. Gives you a decent advantage at sea when you can throw a ball a mile away.
Yeah.
And you'd have 10 of them fired at the same time, and not one of them will blow up. Mm. That's an advantage. So print press, we got the Bible, which some could say that's a curse, but, and also gave you the ability to print money, which is what the government does, it counterfeits money. Any of us done that, we get fucking jailed. Connection to olive trees, because that was their biggest export. Olive trees and olive oil, which is why Greece was so powerful, it was the main commodity. So we'll have a look at Solon and see what he's all about. What I'm suggesting on this is I actually see Atlantis as the first bankrupt. You know, you hear about the decline of the Atlantean Empire. Well, I think it was the first banking system. I actually say, when you hear about it sunk, I think it's sunk under debt. I mean, that's the reason why they got bankrupt, because according to this story, what Plato says is the kings of Atlantis, which was America, tried to dominate the Middle East and the Mediterranean in one foul swoop, and they hit a royal queen that had more firepower, and she ended up ostracising them and costing them. If you look at Plato's Timaeus. But we're going to investigate it. I say on this, Atlantis was the pre-diluvian race of Anunnaki, we'll call them that. It was the first system founded philosophically, socially, philanthropically. You know, they had the information there. They definitely had a sophisticated intelligence, which constituted their nature, because they're bringing a system to us,
which I was looking down and out, it's a different system altogether. They brought a lot of these things to us. But it says, I think it was the first financial collapse, because if you want to control the nation, dominate them, you trick them. You trick them into getting them into money and trading. So I suggested this was all about getting bankrupt. And then they were ostracized because they were naughty. They said, don't do that again, you've been chained for 1,000 years. So that's the way I see it. I could be wrong, but it makes more sense.
Do you equate the Anunnaki with Nimrod, the Sumerian Empire, which is biblical?
I've been listening to stuff about that, and there's a difference. Apparently, they are. They're a different thing.
They're different.
Yeah.
Okay.
They're in Nephilim.
What, the Nimrod?
Or the Nephilim? Apparently. So I've been listening. Steve Quayle. I've listened to.
Okay.
Steve Quayle and Tom Horn. Some of the stuff they're telling me that is well planned off as well. So it's getting a bit more interesting with all that Nephilim and the Watchers and stuff. It's hard to nail because they are different things.
I'm just wondering if the Sumerian. So the Sumerian Empire is to be distinguished from the Atlantean.
I would say they're two different things.
They're two different things, but it's just on there it's got Atlantis was the pre-Diluvian race of Anunnaki. Well, I thought Anunnaki was the Sumerian.
Well, they're all part of the same family.
Right.
So I'll call them that. That's just like the royal family to me. They're all.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, there could be an earlier race, but that's the one. That's
this,
the earliest.
This was pre-Sumerian.
Again, we don't know if the Sumerians were the first, because they came out of nowhere.
That's right, yeah.
But there's other races that have a language that's absent. We don't know where they come from. Welsh is one. Welsh is a family. There is no parent language. That's the only language there is, Welsh. There is no Semitic that it comes from. There is no Indo-European language it's attached to. It's an absolute language. It just stands on its own. Same as Etruscan. That stands on its own. There is no parent to that either. Sumerians, the same cuneiform, don't know where it comes from. Minoan, another one, can't read it. You can describe it, they can't decipher it. Harappan, another one, don't know what the script is, can't work it out. So something was first, we just don't know what. We don't know how long ago. But I'm suggesting it's a bankruptcy.
What about the physical disappearance of Atlantis and Baron? I mean, isn't that something you need to explain? Because obviously we don't know where Atlantis is. So
they're saying it was over the Pillars of Hercules, which would have made it into the Atlantic. We just don't know exactly how big it was and where.
Right.
But he's saying it was as big as Libya, Libyan and Asia Minor. Mm-hmm. So that's quite big.
Mm-hmm.
That's like North Africa, isn't it?
Well, yeah.
So
yeah.
It's quite a big area.
There now, if you're saying it's a financial collapse, which I could agree with, you still got to explain where the actual land went, unless it's somewhere we already know that's got a different name.
Well, it depends if you think we're using copper tools, bows and arrows, or nuclear bombs, which would shake the land and do a lot more damage.
True.
But that's if you accept that we had ancient weaponry, which I do. I don't think they had bows and arrows.
Mm.
Makes no sense.
No. Okay.
So that would be my answer to that one. So yeah, Atlantis was financially cut off and ostracized when they lost, and they did because a woman beat them, which I think has pissed them off ever since. I mean, that's why they're so nasty. Neith, the Egyptian goddess of Egypt. Allegedly, we'll find out in this. But that's how they see you, just you are an ear of corn. Especially when you're doing some of the social engineering on the scale we're doing now, everyone's crop.
Human capital.
Human capital, human stock.
Yeah.
Tradable commerce.
That's why they're using that language.
Personal property is different than real as well. So Plato, 428 to 347 BC. Solon died 559, so we're going to go to Plato in a second. Atlantis was the first brought to the attention of the West by Plato. Madame Helena Blavatsky says Plato was an initiate and obtained his information on Atlantis as part of his initiation, which he went to Heliopolis in the Delta in Egypt. Plato described Atlantis in two of his dialogues to Timaeus and Critias, placing it west of the straits of which you call the Pillars of Heracles, i.e. in the Atlantic Ocean, don't really know exactly where. Solon consulted the ancient records kept by the Egyptians and made a start on the story. Inherited the task and his dialogue Timaeus and the fragments entitled Critias tell part of the story 9,000 years, according to Plato, before Solon's visit to Egypt, when he went to Sais. A great civilization on an island in the Atlantic Ocean disappeared on a day of great rain and earthquakes. Now, if you have a stock market crash, would that equate to the same thing as an analogy? Great rain and earthquakes.
Biblically, earthquake can figuratively mean something like that, an economic collapse.
If your stock market's completely crashed through the floor,
that can be referred to as an earthquake.
It would reverberate on the world.
Appropriate analogy.
So I just maybe it's not an actual earthquake, it might be a euphemism for something else. Plato didn't finish the story, what Solon wrote, and most of it disappeared. Again, there's two sources there. Basic, I mean, it's relatively easy to find. But we go to the Critias, page 2. I like this one because I like gods and goddesses, but I like this one specifically because it mentions this woman, Mnemosyne. It says, but besides the gods and goddesses whom you have mentioned, because there's a pantheon, there's never just the monotheistic god. I would specifically invoke Mnemosyne, for all the important part of my disclosure is dependent upon her favour. So what he means is he's invoking the goddess of memory, so he doesn't forget. And Mnemosyne was a goddess who, when you come here, you drink from one river, and you don't forget, and then you drink from the other one, which will help you remember. So you drink from two rivers, which will help you remember everything, so you don't forget. So you have a purpose, you come here, try and remember, and hope you don't forget, before you finish your task and go back.
He's talking about incarnation.
Well, I don't know whether these agreed with Hinduism or, you know, Buddhism, I don't know. But he seems to understand that you use the muses for power, or to grant you favour. So he's just granting the idea. He hopes he can remember the story. For all the important part of my disclosures depend upon her favour. And if I can recollect and recite enough of what was said by the priests and brought hitherto by Solon, I doubt not that I shall satisfy the requirements of this theatre. So he's hoping they're going to enjoy the story. Let me begin by observing, first of all, that 9,000 years was the sum of the years which had elapsed since the war. Which makes me think, we're in war now, we're in the same countries, we're in the same places, doing exactly the same thing. All involving money. Which was said to have taken place between those that dealt outside the Pillars of Heracles, which would have been Atlantis, America, that side, and all who dwelt within them. This war I'm going to describe. Of the combatants on one side, the city of Athens was reported to have been the leader and to have fought out the war. The combatants on the other side, which would have been the Naughty Americans, were commanded by the kings of America, Atlantis, which, as was saying, was an island greater in extent than Libya and Asia. I mean, that's a big size, though. And when afterwards sunk by an earthquake, or a financial collapse, stock market crash, can't afford to keep funding it, became an impassable barrier of mud to voyagers. You know when you say there's toxic liquidity, there's toxic assets in the system? Wouldn't that make a barrier in mud if you're trying to economically pump money into the financial system? And then all of a sudden you'll have a crash. Wouldn't that be like a barrier in mud? Euphemistically.
Well, you know the phrase dirty money. I mean,
dirty money, yeah. A barrier in mud because you can't get to the assets because there's too much toxic liquidity and there's too many toxic assets that they've got to pump out. Because all this is admiralty law, most of this. I think that's what he's essentially trying to cryptically say. To voyagers sailing from hence to any part of the ocean, which they're all seafaring, the idea that, you know, people haven't been going to America for years is nonsense, that Columbus founded it. In the days of old, the gods had the whole earth distributed among them by allotments, and you'll see this a lot in history. The gods just seem to, like, pick the land and say, that's mine. Don't care who's on it, but that's mine. They, all of them, by just appointment, obtained what they wanted. So it's like, fuck you, Jack, I'm okay, I'm going to take this land, this little plot, and peopled their own districts. And when they had peopled them, they tended us like nurslings and possessions, like plants. Yeah. As shepherds tend their flocks. Here's the interesting part. Accepting only that they did not use blows or bodily force as shepherds do. How many times you read in the Bible, the good shepherd, people in Ernest's interpretation of Greek, they weren't very good. They're like human resource managers. You could see them as that way. My management skills are pretty poor. But governed us like pilots from the stern of the vessel, which is an easy way of guiding animals. So he's not calling you that human. He's telling you what they think of you. You're just something to be guided. Holding our souls by the rudder of persuasion according to their own pleasures. Thus did they guide all mortal creatures. It's hardly flattering language. Is it? But it's interesting, he's took the Egyptian mode that they'll model you and form you and cultivate you like you're nothing more than a seed to be harvested.
Yeah.
You're just there to serve them.
Getting everybody to be upset.
To be harvested. It's the new age nonsense. So the guide and the rudder, which we are, we're all vessels, aren't we? We'll carry our information. I mean, that's how we commercially are worth something, because we've got stuff in there that people want. So to carry this around, you've got to get conveyance, usually, or a car. But in those days, the analogy was a ship. You're carrying valuable cargo, your intelligence, commerce, how you were moulded. Sheep, you just farm, the animal farm. Each of the 10 kings, talk about Atlantis, which would be America, each of the 10 kings in his own divisions and his own city had the absolute control of the citizens. So that's absolute monarchy or absolute tyranny, one of the two. And in most cases, of the laws, punishing and slaying whomever he would. So Atlantis doesn't sound as cuddly as they make out in history, does it? You know, they have all the crystal towers and everything was divine. Like, well, he's not saying that, he's saying it's a tyranny. Now, the order of precedence among them and their mutual relations, which is all the friends and family, brothers, sisters, you know, all the hangers-on, were regulated by the commands of Poseidon, which is Neptune, isn't it? Yeah. Were they all serving Neptune before? And this is defined as a pagan god, which the law had handed down. These were inscribed by the first kings. Now, we don't know who the first kings were. On a pillar of oraculum. Funny, it's all these pillars. Again, you're talking about biblical stuff there, because they're like pillars. They're like sacrifice as well. At the temple of Poseidon, whither the kings were gathered together every fifth and sixth year, alternatively. Fifth and sixth is basically masculine and feminine. Every time you see a five, it's a male number. Every time you see a six, it's feminine. Or every odd number is male. Every even number is female. In esoterically, alternately giving equal honour to the omni ruler, and that's true, that is fact. So again, you look at that and think, what kind of system are they following here? I mean, this is odd. This is page 9 of Critias. There were bulls who had the reins of the temple of Poseidon, and the 10 kings, being left alone in the temple, after they had offered prayers to the god, that they may capture the victim. So they talk about real bulls, or they talk about men, human men, that they're just going to hunt. But they call them bulls. I'm just wondering if that's not really a bull. If that would be the dominant male, the alpha male in the city, town, whatever it be. Which was acceptable to him, hunted the bulls, and the bull which they caught, they led up to the pillar and cut its throat. Over the top of it, the pillow, so the blood fell down in the sacred inscription. Kicker, the bottom. Now on the pillar, besides the laws, so the killing's something. So the blood drips down over the sacred laws which they've inscribed in stone on this special oracle. I think it's like red granite or something like that. There was inscribed an oath invoking mighty curses on the disobedient. I mean, that's just the same as the Bible, same as Islam. You've either got to be subservient or obedient to things, otherwise you get done in for being disobedient because you don't listen. Don't want me blessed like that anyway. But it's just interesting. Yeah, it's just interesting. It's blood. Again, you always see blood.
Isn't it Freemasonry? You put blood on lentils, I've heard. Don't know if that's going to touch on.
Again, there's so many orders and so many secret societies. You wouldn't know which one follows which one's the correct one or the first one. You just don't know. But it's just interesting. They're using blood, not water. But which doesn't make sense to me unless there's something nefarious to it. Because you've taken life. The whole point is you don't take life. You do sacred bulls for different rituals. You don't do it for that, which is all to do with victims. So you get tagged, don't you? You get branded. I'm wearing brands. Are you wearing brands?
Do you mean clothing?
Clothing, yeah.
I don't think I am. Maybe.
Well, that's basically what they do to you. Even though you are a cow to be suckled and supply some energy, you're also tagged every day. You're branded from birth. It's like the cross. But it's religion, that's the cross in your head. It's the religious cross they brand you with. Very clever system, they give you that straight from birth. Have a cross, just to remind you that you're branded, but they'll mask it with religion and say, worship this god fella. Which is really money. That's their idol they give you. So it hasn't really ended. Idolatry. It's quite funny. Everyone claims to be religious, but they serve money. You know, it's still the same thing. If they were true Christians, they wouldn't serve him. So carries on, page 3. This is like a translation from Benjamin Jowett, who was supposed to be an authority on this. So it goes on with the Critias. Then listen, Socrates, which there's 3 of them. There's Socrates, Aristotle. He says, to a tale which, though strange, is certainly true, having been attested by Solon, which means this is viable, no, it's an authority, who was the wisest of the 7 sages. He was a relative of a dear friend of my grandmother, Dropides, as he himself says in many passages of his poems, and he told the story to my grandfather. So it's all word of mouth, passing it through. They were of old, he said, great and marvellous actions of the Athenian city. So the question is, how old? Which had passed into oblivion through lapses of time and the destruction of mankind, and one in particular greater than all the rest. Very good. What is this ancient famous action? Declared on the authority of Solon. So every time you declare something, you're attesting something, you're saying it's true. Usually that's in the best, especially for me who's an authoritarian. Not to be a legend, but an actual fact. There isn't much of this book, so you're going by what he's saying. So he goes to Sais, which is in Heliopolis, ancient Egyptian site. In the first place, you remember a single deluge only, but there were many previous ones. For there was a time, Solon, before the great deluge of all, which we don't know when that was, but it was definitely within the last 10,000 years, when the city, which is now Athens, was first in war, and in every way performed the noblest deeds and to have the fairest constitution of any which tradition tells of under the face of heaven. Now to say there's a constitution means it's an organised structure, isn't it? I mean, that's a no-brainer. If you have a civilised nation, you'll abide by certain laws made by judges which they believe is fair, you know, just. No. So he's saying that it's a fully functioning system. They had all different tiers. They brought in another 300 a bit later on. He brought in a lot of things. Solon, he expanded it, but it also lost a lot of control as well, because it went out of his control as well. But yeah, he tried to bring more justice in to try and get a bit fairer. But yeah, constitution, so it was already written. How long ago? He's saying 9,000 years ago. Neith, goddess who in the common patron of parents and educator of both our cities. That's an Egyptian queen. She founded your city 1,000 years before ours, receiving from the earth and Hephaestus, which is a Vulcan, a planet, the seed of your race, and afterwards she founded ours, of which the constitution is recorded in the sacred registers to be 8,000 years old. So what he's saying there is Athens was first 9,000 years BC, and then Egypt. Now that goes against history, because they say history was Alexander the Great in 335 BC. I'd say 9,000 years ago there was an ancient city of Athens. So if they've got all the information and NASA keeps sending all these probes up and they're giving them all Greek names and everything to do with astrology, what did they see? I think the Greeks saw a lot more than what they're telling us in history, to be honest, because most of it's analogies, you know, it's all Perseus and all these battles in the solar system. They're talking about ancient wars, so was it on land or was it in the sky? Or was it both? Because they're talking about seeing them in under the face of heaven, which is just the sky, not space. It doesn't say 2 heavens or 3 heavens, it just says under the face of heaven. Which which is above Apulia. But it's interesting, it brings in Neith, which is not even a major goddess, really. It's very odd. I mean, Neith is an archetype of Sekhmet, in a way, which is a sister of Isis. But she fits the archetype of, I'd say, of Neith, especially because she's a war goddess, but she's also fair. I mean, she can invoke terrible wrath and pain on you. But she can also be very calm, civilized, and nurture mankind. So she can be either or. She can be your world's worst nightmare, or your ultimate friend. But if you're going against her, and the kings of Atlantis met something like that, who's got a lot of power, then that makes a lot more sense. She was no Muppet. She's the oldest god as well. You probably won't see that, but they're just four different theologies of the same pantheon. Different ones have, see that this one's Ptah, which is Menphite theology. Again, you have nine different gods on the tree. So you've got that one, Hermopolitan, I think it is. Most of them are always sun and moon gods, that's all they are, and the brothers and sisters. But I just think it's around these time frames we're dealing with, Aries and Taurus. As we transition into Moses, which is the ram in the thicket. So you have a lot of astrological markers there. Whether it is that, no, that's 4000 BC, or 5000, between 4000 and 2000 BC. So, gone crazy.
Aries was the one of the shuttle, isn't it? It's
what?
Aries. It's one of the, like you say, one of the
massive
things.
Yeah.
It's a rocket, I think, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's spelled Ares, Ares, isn't it?
Yeah,
which is Mars.
Mars, exactly. Yeah.
And that's what Ares is, Mars.
Yeah.
But there's your Ogdode. It's basically the pantheon. You've got Amun at the top, or Atun. And you've got Shu, Tefnut, or Tefnet. And these are the main ones you hear about in history. Nut and Geb, who's the sky and the earth goddess. They basically trickle the water down onto the earth grows. You know, it's all basically creation myths, just to give you an idea. And this is stuff I've done years ago, but I just thought I'd throw it in just to give you an idea of what the Egyptian gods would all support. Nothing crazy. So confirmed accounts. Solon was in Heliopolis in the Nile Delta with said priests, we confirm that. Athens and Lower Egypt was interwoven with Neith. Otherwise known as Athene, Aphrodite, or perhaps the older Isis, Sekhmet, Hathor, Trine, or Triangle, whatever you want to call them, which is pre-Egypt, because we don't know how old Egypt is. We really don't know. Or you can have the triple aspect of Ninhasak, Inanna, Ishtar, of the earliest Sumerians. So she's a culmination, she's got a lot of power. Egypt's constitution was primarily founded on military pursuits, which it is. Look at any Egyptian, especially the 18th dynasty, they're all trained in military. Every single son and daughter are trained to be military chiefs or military leaders. And she, the goddess, is the same as Blavatsky said, war and water, war and wisdom. She holds both. And that one there, wherefore the goddess, who was a lover of both war and wisdom, selected the first of all, settled that spot, which was the most likely to produce men like herself. Because that's what they do, they like to mould people. Like, if you've got a certain image, they like you to be exactly like them. That's casting your image on someone and projecting. So that's what he's saying, she wants to produce more like her, to be fair and warfare and wise. And there you dwelt, having such laws as those, and still better ones. Now, if you live in a tyranny, I don't know whether it be a good constitution, but Aristotle was a bit interested on that, because he could say, basically, if you lived in a city in Greece, you could be in a polis, which means you could have democracy in a polis, and you could still have a tyranny in another polis. But as long as he functioned and worked, it didn't matter. As long as they did what they were functioning to do. Do the things and pay tax, or you know, make the government function. You could be any state you like. You could be in a despotism. You could be in a bit of a neocon American kind of system. But as long as it worked, it would be the same. It would be a polis or a metropolis. That's what it means. Yeah, polis is city, just a city state. again, we've got dictatorships everywhere, but they are still policies, according to Aristotle. A little symbol for war and wars there. Many great and wonderful deeds are recorded of your state in our histories, but none of them exceeds all the rest in greatness and valour, for these histories tell of a mighty power. Remember, we went back to the beginning when the guy said, there's a power. We don't know what's behind it. We don't know where the base is. A mighty power which unprovoked, which means they didn't do anything to deserve it, made an expedition against the whole of Europe and Asia. So the kings of Atlantis decided to make a global push like Hitler did. Unfortunately, it didn't quite work because they met the match. And to which your city put an end. So Neith sorted the kings out. This power came forth out the Atlantic Ocean, for in those days the Atlantic was navigable. Now, the very idea that Columbus found in America because he got the maps and he found it because he knew where to look is nonsense, because Gunnar Thompson proved that. There's a map from 1418. That's about 130 years before Columbus ever got there. Mm-hmm. So the Chinese had a map. I'm not sure where this one's from, but I know that guy Gunnar Thompson, it was on his website, so I don't know where he sourced it from. But I believe it's in a museum somewhere, or it's been in a museum. But it's quite an accurate map. And they actually say it's too accurate. It's too accurate to be done from previous records. There's obviously a lot of records to give that accurate map to get it to that stage. They must have previous ones. So if that's the oldest previous one, then it blows Columbus out the water.
It shows the whole globe, doesn't it, really?
Yeah. That's 1418. I mean, we all know the Egyptians and the Phoenicians were all seafarers. They were all travelling to America. It's pretty conclusive now that South America was trading with Egypt. We know that. So, according to Blavatsky, everyone likes Blavatsky. She's the big Luciferian that everyone's scared of. Serious Study of Atlantis Anthology, as it's called by some, is said to have started with the book Atlantis, the Antediluvian World of Ignatius Donnelly. If anyone wants it, I've got it as a PDF if you want to read it. It's quite shocking, some of it. Published in 1882. Donnelly does indeed deserve much credit for his seminal book, which did elicit much interest. Probably his book still has much value today, and it does, it's an interesting book. Interestingly, though, there's been a theosophical hand behind the dissemination of the Atlantis story, and that is traced here. Blavatsky mentioned Atlantis numerous times in Isis Unveiled, another book you should read, because again they talk about the power of Lucifer, and it's not what you think. There she gave out hints and details of Atlantis and commented favourably on its existence.
Could you just clarify your comment about Lucifer?
In Isis Unveiled, what she essentially says, and it's the same as Manly P. Hall and a few other ones, Lucifer is an energy. It's an electromagnetic energy. And it's basically channeled from either a region behind the sun, or it's a planet that would conjunct behind the sun at one point or another. If that makes sense.
Okay.
It will come through the sun either way. They're trying to use the sun as a channel to focus it, yeah. That's my interpretation, because they're using energy, it's an electrical field. Like the electric universe, that's Lucifer.
But black sun.
It could be from the... I mean, they say the black sun is galactic centre, because it's a big black hole. And it pulls the light in. And then all the other stuff blows it out.
I thought there was the association with Venus.
It is, but we don't. I don't personally think Lucifer is Venus himself. But they do. I mean, they look to. She must have a certain quality about it that I don't know about. But she does make a pentagram in the sky. Yes. And over time, it spins. The star will spin in the sky. So whether that's your pentagram link, hyperdimensional physics, I don't know. All I know is these are identified as power, a physical electromagnetic power. You can manipulate with will and intent. Again, depends how you want to define Lucifer. There's a couple of, I mean, sometimes I see Lucifer as the moon. I've got, for some bizarre reason, I've got a connection that Lucifer's power is the moon, but that's weird.
Read the latest David
Icke
book.
I've stored stuff before, like, years ago.
Sure.
But he's gone into the moon.
He's got it all from
Gurgin. Yeah. He's just going over stuff. Finally, now that I've looked into for the last 10 years.
Stuff.
He stayed on reptilians so long without thinking, well, that's a mindset. It's not really a reptilian. It's more of a way of being. But yeah, he carries on there. Mysteriously found its way to the Atlantic. When, at what period? History is silent on that point, and it is. History about 8,000 BC is quite. It's about 3,000 years, it's really, really silent. But there are those that consider there is no tradition, sanctified by angels, without a certain sediment of truth at the bottom of it. Believe in the Atlantis legend. There are, scattered throughout the world, a handful of thoughtful and solitary students who pass their lives in obscurity. These men believe the story of Atlantis to be no fable, like Solon didn't, but maintain that at different epochs of the past, huge islands and even continents existed, where now there is but a wild waste of waters. Which you could say that any country that's been decimated by a stock and being taken over would just change its name, that wouldn't exist anymore. Just like the United States of America is now no longer called the United States of America, it's called the United States. And England is now called UK. So that's how you can make them disappear. Don't sometimes think they can, well, they might display completely under the water. I mean, we've got sunken remnants of Indian in India, isn't that? What's the latest one? We found something 8,000 BC in the underwater. Sadly found. Have you seen that one? No, it's been dated to 8,000 BC. So that just blew a lot of things out the water by finding that one. But this is Blavatsky.net, again, just an online site. Bizarre. In conclusion, Blavatsky's writings were achieving considerable notice, and anyone interested in Atlantis, which we all go there doing the study, would likely have encountered her work. Interestingly, Isis Unveiled quotes page 179 of Baldwin's Prehistoric Nations on the origin of the name Atlantis. It is an interesting part. Baldwin traces the name not to the Greek Atlas, but to the Central American word atl, meaning water and war. Blavatsky is there bringing forward further interesting evidence to link the old and the new world and to suggest the reality of Atlantis. 5 years later, Donnelly agrees and references the same exact quote from Baldwin in his chapter, Corroborating Circumstances. 6 years later, she brings out her own, which is a massive two-volume work. But it's just interesting that it's nothing to do with Atlas, it's to do with water and war. Knowledge and wisdom and firepower. Very interesting connection. I think this is pretty much the end of it. It's only a small presentation. Anyone read PNAC in America, the Project for the New American Century?
Aware of it. Yeah. That's the smoking gun about 9/11, isn't it?
Yeah.
The real problem.
90 pages of just pure terrifying reading. It basically tells you that the American system wants to basically have four simultaneous wars to prove that they can do it. That's essentially what the goal is, and to be overwatchers and protectors of all the global systems, just to prove that he can do it. And they're going to use all kinds of horrible technology as well.
The information where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.